yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets of screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, in recent weeks we've been talking about Greece. And you know, it's just too important not to continue talking about Greece. And a lot has been happening since the last show. Things moving very fast and getting even more complicated. But I think the parties will probably soon agree to a new deal, and here's why. But before we get into the details of why, you've got to understand the global strategic significance of this and these debt negotiations. This isn't just a small economy on the periphery of Europe that constitutes only 2% of total European GDP, or 0.2% of global GDP. It's far more important what's going on there. Why is this Greek debt situation and the negotiations so important? Well, first of all, what Greece represents is a challenge to global neoliberalism, the Euro version of that, but globally as well. In previous shows, I talked about this idea coming out of the 1970s, where the U.S. Went on, and the U.K. as a junior partner, went on this new offensive restructuring the global capitalist economy. And folks who understand what neoliberalism is, think of it largely in terms of domestic policy. In other words, you drive down wages, you destroy unions, you shift taxes in favor of investors and corporations, a whole number of other offensives. You eliminate defined benefit pensions, you privatize health insurances, and so forth. Those are all very true and elements. But, you know, there's another important aspect, and that aspect of neoliberalism is on the international front, the international trade and currency and exchange, which isn't so obvious sometimes, but it's probably even more important than some of the domestic policies. The two you can't have one without the other. You can't have domestic neoliberalism and global international neoliberalism one without the other. They both complement the other. And that's what I meant when I talked a few weeks ago about this twin deficit idea the U.S. launched under Reagan. The twin deficits, just to repeat briefly, is you run a big trade deficit. The U.S. decided to run a big trade deficit instead of, in previous years as it did, trying to maintain a trade surplus. So you run a big trade deficit. In other words, you buy far more from other countries abroad. And by the way, what you do is allow your companies, your multinational companies, to move abroad. You give them all kinds of incentives, foreign direct investment, taxes, and so forth, so that you are really importing not simply goods from other countries, you are re-importing goods from U.S. companies that moved offshore. And of course, their costs of production are far less, therefore their profits are greater, and they move jobs offshoring, right? So that's part of creating this trade deficit. It's not just with other countries, it's with the same corporations that used to have jobs in here in the U.S., but they moved them offshore, and now they're re-importing this stuff back to us. Okay, so whether it's with U.S. companies that have moved abroad or indigenous companies, capitalist companies who are offshore, we buy more from them, okay? And we sell less to them. So we get a big trade deficit. But part of striking this deal with these other countries, part of that whole deal is that they will agree to recycle the money that they get, the extra money they get from selling exports to us, recycle it back to the U.S. It goes through their central banks, and their central banks then turn around and buy U.S. treasuries, right? So buying all these U.S. treasuries, the money flows back to the U.S. that flowed out, right? Consumers who bought these goods offshore, the money flows back to the central bank. And of course, we know, what does the central bank do with that lately? Well, it gives it back to investors and bankers and big corporations. Okay, so that's the latest twist in this whole thing. But the most important point is that this comes back, this money comes back to the treasury, and we get this big inflow of recycled capital. A lot of the trade deficit had to do with paying very high crude oil prices, goes to the Saudis and their friends, and then it comes back. The Saudis reinvest in the U.S. They buy treasury bonds, they buy F-15s, and so forth. So the money comes back there. We run a big trade deficit always with Japan and with Europe. And of course, the big one, another big one, is with China now since 2000, since we let them in to the World Trade Organization and the trading blocks of global capitalism. That was the understanding too. And of course, they like the idea because you're buying a lot of Chinese manufactured goods. So it's easy to convince them that, okay, if you're going to stimulate our economy by buying our goods, we'll agree to recycle this stuff. And so they recycle the money back to the U.S., which allows the U.S. to cut taxes on the rich, right? And allows the U.S. To increase spending on defense. In other words, allows the U.S. to increase its budget deficit. So the trade deficit enables the budget deficit, and we continue to run a budget deficit because the money that we're going to spend on the deficit is really coming back from offshore. So the trade deficit enables a budget deficit. And this has worked very nicely for the U.S. The U.S. negotiated deals in the 1980s, with Europe and Japan and other places, and then 2000 with China, and even before that had the deal going with in the late 70s with the petrodollar countries and economies. Okay, so then Europe tries to replicate this. Why? Because you need a stable currency, a single currency here, and that's the dollar. The dollar is a reserve currency, is a trading currency, and everyone will accept it. Well, Europe does the same thing after 2000. It creates the euro, and the euro puts the manufacturing countries like Germany and Netherlands and so forth in a catbird seat, and it allows those manufacturing countries to sell their manufacturing goods to the euro periphery, Greece and the southern periphery and so forth. And to do that, though, they have to loan money to those periphery countries to buy those German goods. Northern Euro and German banks loan the money to these countries, to these banks in these countries that'll then recycle it to businesses and so forth. They buy into these banks in the periphery and vice versa, and they send their corporations, German corporations, set up subsidiaries and so forth in the periphery. The money flows essentially to those corporations, to the banks, and the spending and the influx of huge amounts of liquidity also stimulates the housing markets, where prices were once very, very low, and northern is like the sunny sunny climes there of southern Europe. So you get a lot of housing expansion on top of the general expansion in the periphery. But it all is enabled because the money is flowing from the north to the periphery. And the periphery does well economically, you know, a lot of spending, a lot of new money capital here, and they're buying a lot of northern goods, and some of the money raises the wealth and income in the periphery, and people start consuming more, spending more, and so forth. And if you're expanding the economy, you got to expand the infrastructure, so some of the money goes to the governments in these countries that expand the borrowing, that expand the infrastructure, and of course you expand government, because everybody participates in the largesse, and you get a huge economic growth. But then we have the 2009-10 global contraction, and the money stops flowing from the north to the periphery. And the asset values of the housing and so forth collapse at the same time. Oh, okay, so how are you going to keep paying that? Well, you then have to loan money to the periphery to enable them to pay the interest on the debt you previously loaned to them. Okay, and your banks are in trouble. So in the periphery, so the banks have to be bailed out, and the central banks borrow money from the north, and you know, to bail out their banks, and then other consumers and households need to be bailed out, and other companies need to be bailed out. So particularly the bailout of the banks in the periphery, the money has to come through the government. Because the governments in the periphery then provide the money to their banking system to bail it out. So government debt rises, you see, because the flow stops from the north. But the interest has to be paid on the debt nonetheless from the south to the north. Well, you loan them, the north loans them money in order to pay interest and principal on the debt it previously ran up. Down there. Okay, so that buys a little time, and the understanding was you could grow out of this because the recession is going to end in 2011. Well, it didn't. They fell back into a double dip in 2012, and especially in Greece, they had to really increase the debt. And in that 2012 bailout, the Northern Europeans created Euro-wide stability rescue funds to do just that, to bail out the periphery. And in the process of redoing the debt terms in 2012, they, in the case of Greece, they, the Northern Stability Funds, the European Commission, the European Central Bank, and IMF, what they did is buy out, pay off, buy out the private investors, most of them. So they converted the debt largely to all government debt owned to these three agencies in the North Troika. And that's where we are right now today. And, of course, in Europe, the whole practice has been, more of a monetary policy as a way to bail out and not a fiscal policy. And that's exactly the situation that occurs in Europe today. If you look at globally, neoliberalism, another element of it, of neoliberalism, is you've got to hold the line on fiscal spending. Neoliberalism means monetary policy first. And if you look across the globe, that's exactly what's been the case since 2009. It's all been monetary policy. In other words, central banks trying to inject liquidity, money into the economy with the hope, false as it's proven, that injecting money into the banks, they will then lend and stimulate the economy and, you know, provide loans to businesses, which will then invest and create jobs and so forth. And by pumping money into the economy, it will provoke speculation to some extent, and speculation will raise equity values, and companies will fill now with greater total worth there, net worth. Their balance sheets will look better because their stock prices have risen, and they will invest as well now because they will feel that they're not underwater. anymore. Their debts aren't greater than their income flow. Their balance sheets will be better because stock prices have risen, therefore they will invest. Well, that hasn't happened either, you see. The banks have not lent, and even though stock prices have gone through the roof, instead of businesses with higher stock valuations and therefore better balance sheets, instead of them investing in real assets that create jobs, they just keep investing in financial assets and driving the prices up even more. Or instead of investing, they turn around and they give bigger dividend payouts to their rich stockholders, or they provide stock buybacks. You see, it all gets sucked into the financial asset market instead of dribbling out, as central banks had thought, into the rest of the economy, right? But that was the theory, right? You throw money and bail out the banks, they'll lend. You throw money into the stock market, it'll drive up prices and values, and therefore businesses will invest. And the other idea was if you throw out money there, it will increase the inflation level, and if prices are rising, businesses will also feel more likely to want to invest. So monetary policy had this theoretical objective of indirectly, by making the rich richer, investors richer, companies richer, banks bailed out, that would result in investment, real jobs, real income. But it didn't happen. Very little of that actually happened. But now, why do they do this? Why is that the strategy rather than fiscal stimulus? In other words, providing government spending and, you know, government tax cuts for households and consumers. Why not more of that rather than monetary policy? Because the whole idea of monetary policy means make the rich richer real quick, and maybe some of it will dribble down to the rest, you see, and the rest will be dragged along. Whereas if you say, okay, government spending and consumer tax cuts, the whole idea is to bail out Main Street and put money in the hands of general consumers and workers who will then buy the goods that will then result in some profit accruing to the business and investor side. You see, who gets rich first and how much is really the thing that distinguishes fiscal policy from monetary policy. If you look globally since 2009, you see three examples of this mix between fiscal and monetary policy. In Europe, you see total monetary policy, and not very effective, dribbling it out even on the monetary side, and absolutely no fiscal stimulus. In fact, negative fiscal stimulus. That's called austerity. See, they rolled their dice totally on monetary policy, but they only rolled one dice at a time. And now, of course, they're trying desperately to open up the monetary spigot with their most recent quantitative easing program, and trying to accelerate the monetary side. But the practice has always been in Europe, offset the monetary with fiscal, in other words, negative fiscal, reduce spending, right? Don't provide tax cuts to consumers and households. Rely totally on the monetary side. It's been a disaster, of course. Europe's been in and out of recessions and stagnant pretty much. And even the latest QE, which is over $1 trillion dedicated monetary injection, is not having the effects that they thought it would. It's not really driving that stock market up very much. It did a little bit, but now it's sort of settled back down because there's other problems in Europe that are offsetting that we'll talk about. Okay, so it didn't really happen. Okay, it didn't really happen the way it was supposed to, and it hasn't had an effect on prices as well in terms of price levels in Europe. Okay, so neither the stock markets nor the inflation has risen, and because you don't have a real investment going on You don't have real income growth, and therefore demand by households and consumers is not very great, and therefore you get the drift towards deflation in Europe, you see. So it's not working in Europe. That mix was total monetary mix and negative fiscal mix. Now you move over to the U.S., and what do you see there? Well, the mix is a little different since 2009. We had this massive monetary injection. I mean, massive, several QE rounds, you know, $15 to $20 trillion probably of central bank, Federal Reserve, injecting money into the system. As I've said many times, that money did not have a major effect on stimulating the real economy. A lot of it went offshore to emerging markets. A lot of it went into financial asset speculation. Stock and bond markets surged to record levels. And a lot of it was just hoarded by businesses and redistributed to their wealthy investors in the form of dividends and stock buybacks. Just the S&P 500 corporations in the U.S. have distributed since 2010 $5 trillion. That's just the largest 500 U.S. corporations. $5 trillion in stock buybacks and dividends. That's only 500, you know. I mean, there's a couple million corporations in the U.S., and the data that we have on total dividend payouts for all U.S. corporations are, you know, at least another $2 trillion. So there's $7 trillion we know of. We don't know of stock buybacks. At least I don't have the data on that for all the other smaller corporations below the 500 largest, right? So that's probably a trillion or so. So we've got, since 2010, somewhere between $7 and $8 trillion that's been redistributed by corporations to their investors. Not invested by the corporations, redistributed, okay? And what else did they do? A lot of that money they sent offshore to invest in emerging markets. And some of that they sent back into financial markets all around the world. So $15, $20 trillion of central bank injection, U.S. central bank, you know, and somewhere around $10, $15 trillion probably of spending, quote, spending by U.S. corporations, but not spending on real investment that creates real jobs, you know, spending in the sense of giving stock buybacks and dividends, spending in the sense of investing abroad in emerging markets, you know, in Brazil and China and places like that, right? Right. And other forms of just hoarding, they're still sitting on $2 trillion, the largest corporations, a cash hoard, even after all this foreign investment, even after all this financial speculation, you know, even after all the buybacks. You can almost do a simple arithmetic, adding and subtracting here of the 15 to 20 trillion of the U.S. central bank injection, money injection, and, you add up to $7, $8 trillion in buybacks and dividends, several more trillion invested in financial markets around the world, several more into investing in real development in emerging markets around the world, sitting on $2, $3 trillion more, hoarding it, and who knows what they got in their tax shelters. And it comes up about the same amount of money. Now, that's the monetary problem, massive monetary policy in the U.S. But the U.S. had a token fiscal policy mix since 2009. The first thing that Obama did was to come up with $787 billion in government spending. $787 billion. About a third of that was tax cuts, of course. But another third was subsidies given to the states, the U.S. states, and the rest was, different kind of spending. So it really, real effective immediate spending was only, $200-300 billion, but it was something. It was more than the austerity negative spending in the case of Europe. So we did have some fiscal spending. And then we supplemented that with a second round of of quote government spending in the form of massive tax cuts for corporations and businesses and investors. That was at the end of 2010. That was the second bailout program. Almost totally, you know, there's $55 billion in unemployment insurance supplements, but the rest was $800 billion in tax cuts, continuing tax cuts. But, you know, that's the kind of, you know, government action, you could say, right? Fiscal action. Taxes are fiscal action. Spending is fiscal action. So the U.S. had some kind of a fiscal stimulus, maybe about $1.7 trillion, dwarfs compared to the $10 trillion-plus of the central bank. But it was something. However, that something was then retracted in August, starting in August 2011, with the first deficit debt deal. The government took back $1 trillion of its spending, $1 trillion, and then it had a delayed second trillion that was to occur at the end of 2012, half of which was defense spending, and half of which was program spending, social program spending. Okay, so $1 trillion of the $1.7 trillion total fiscal stimulus in the U.S. 2009-10 was taken back in 2011, and then a year later or so, when it came, okay, the fiscal cliff, it was called. What's going to happen here with the fiscal cliff? The government allowed half of that second trillion to be taken back. And the other half, which was defense, it allowed to go forward. And in the process, it extended tax cuts worth $4 trillion over the next decade, mostly for corporations and investors. Okay, that's the fiscal picture in the U.S. So to sum up, the U.S. had a fiscal stimulus, a very minor, modest one, imbalance towards subsidies and imbalance towards tax cuts, but it was some kind of a fiscal stimulus initially in 2009-10-11, first half of 11. But then what it did was take it back, take it all back immediately, okay? And well, not immediately, but took it back later, took it back in 2012, right? So you give a little bit, then you take it back, right? Except for the defense spending, you didn't take that back. But there was a kind of a mix there between monetary and fiscal, way weighted towards monetary, a little bit towards fiscal, right? Contrast that with the third example of a monetary-fiscal mix in the case of China. In 2009, what did China do? China also engaged in massive monetary stimulus into its economy, not QEs, but stimulus through its banking system, government banking system, into the economy. But it accompanied that monetary stimulus with an equally massive fiscal stimulus, equivalent to about 15% of China's GDP at the time. You know, the U.S. Token stimulus was about 4% of its GDP, and again, very imbalanced towards subsidies and tax cuts. But in China, the stimulus was government investment, massive government investment to stimulate the economy. So you have these three case examples across the world of different degrees and forms of neoliberalism. And in all cases, they involve massive monetary injections by the central banks into the banks and investors and corporations in those economies. But the difference is the degree of fiscal stimulus. At one extreme, you got China with massive fiscal stimulus. At the other extreme, you got Europe with austerity, negative fiscal stimulus. In between, you got the U.S. playing this little token game and quickly pulling back from it after a couple years and just relying on monetary policy. That's neoliberalism. You see, this twin deficit thing is part of neoliberalism's total policy structure, total policy mix that was developed in the 1980s. And Europe is a caricature of that. When they create the euro, they can play this twin deficits game like the U.S. does globally. They play it within Europe. and the northern Germans and so forth economies benefit massively at first from this whole process. You know, they loan money, it all comes back, and then they got to pay interest, the periphery, on the money that was loaned, that was sent back, you see. A nice, sweet deal. Sweet deal. And it all works until the collapse starts in 2009-10. And then another double-dip recession in 2012. And what you've got then is a $300 billion-plus, in the case of Greece, of debt that cannot be paid because their economy is only about $180 billion GDP a year. Where are they going to get the money to pay, right? Well, up to now, the whole idea was that they have the money to pay, but that money that they're using, to pay is taken out of their economy, so they can't grow their economy. They got to, whatever the growth they have, they got to send it to the north in interest payments, and it's totally impossible to continue that. But boy, this is a nice, sweet setup for the big capitalists in Europe, in the U.S., in the north, and in the U.S., and to some extent Japan as well. Okay, this is neoliberalism in terms of global economic policy here. And what we see in Greece is an attempt to disrupt that. Greece, under its newly elected democratic government, Tsipras, their prime minister, and Syriza, the dominant party there, are essentially saying to the rest of the Eurozone, hey, this whole system has us total indebted forever to you and locked into a timeless depression. Something's wrong here. You know, you guys got rich off of this, and you let us share in the richness for a while, and now you turn the screws. You shut off the spigot, and now all we got to do is pay debt. This isn't fair. We have a democratic elected government, and we want something else. We want a different arrangement with you. But no, Greece, you cannot have a different arrangement because this is the global neoliberal regime, and we're not going to let little old Greece, 2% of GDP in the Eurozone, upset this whole apple cart for us. No, we're not going to do that. We can't create that precedent. And Greece is saying, well, what we want to do is return to old-fashioned European social democracy. What a safety net and so forth. And the Europeans and North say, no, safety net's got to go. That's not part of neoliberalism. In your case, it's got to go all at once because you're in debt to us. But, we're working on it even with our own countries of taking apart the safety net. It's a little more difficult for us, But we're doing it. It's called labor market reforms, you see. That's what it's all about. Cut pensions, right? Create more part-time jobs. Privatize the healthcare system, right? And all the other safety net, eliminate all the safety net provisions that were greater in Europe than the U.S. because Europe had this deal after post-World War II where the U.S. would pay the bill for defense spending. And in exchange, Europe would be the tail on the U.S. foreign policy dog, right? But in the meantime, we the Europeans can spend this on ourselves, on our safety net and so forth, right? That was a nice arrangement that they had. Of course, they gave up their whole independence when it comes to doing their own foreign policy, and we see that really clearly in what's going on in Ukraine and in Eastern Europe right now with NATO. Okay, that's another story, though. So what we have is Greece trying to challenge the whole European, and therefore global, neoliberal strategy. And those who are benefiting from this, the bankers, the rich, the investors, and so forth, they love this strategy, this whole approach. And they're not going to let Greece challenge it. And in fact, they're fighting on a number of fronts, these global capitalists, to maintain this neoliberal structure. You can think of the dust up here going with Russia Russia, you're not playing by the rules here. You haven't really bought into this neoliberal thing totally the way we want you to. So you've got this conflict going on over Russia. The surrogate here is the Ukraine, but really what's behind the conflict with Russia is the United States did not like Europe getting too close and too dependent economically on Russia. So it wants to split Europe from Russia, particularly over gas and oil and so forth. But in general, trade was deepening between Russia and Putin is not, a reliable neoliberal here. So they're challenging him there. And you can look at China, the same thing. There's a challenge. China won't totally accept the neoliberal relationships here. And the U.S. is struggling against China. Of course, it's got to be a little more careful with China because so much money is to be made and coming out of China. And China has trillions of dollars of U.S. Currency and reserves, and the U.S. needs that to come back if it wants to run its budget deficit and continue its twin deficit deal. But China and the U.S. are in this tug and push kind of relationship. The U.S. does not want China to get economically more powerful. We saw that over the fight with this Asian investment bank. The U.S. deposed, but China was able to pull off that coup because it's been seeding money into Europe, keeping it afloat here for the last 4 or 5 years, and the Europeans jumped ship and joined their investment, China's investment bank, which is a direct challenge to the U.S.-dominated World Bank and its ally, Japan's Asian bank. And, of course, we see the conflict with China continuing economically as China moves its currency towards a trading currency. And this whole Trans-Pacific trade deal is also integral to the challenge and trying to offset China's growing economic influence. And, of course, on the political-military front, it's all this pivot towards Asia going on as well. But, China and Russia aren't really totally reliable as part of the neoliberal deal. And we see the U.S. also challenging, beginning to move once again into Latin America. When it was distracted in the Middle East, Iran is not part of neoliberalism, and ISIS and Syria are mavericks here as well. We have to oppose them. And in Latin America, there's a reorientation by U.S. To try to get that under control. Too many democratic regimes arose in the last decade since the crisis who are trying to craft their own direction. Venezuela, of course, efforts to destabilize that are underway, have been for a while in the U.S., what about the orientation to Cuba? Well, this is all part of divide and conquer, you bring Cuba, into the fold or try to, you welcome Rousseff, the president of Brazil here recently, and try to break them off from this independence movement, economic independence movement in Latin America. At the same time, you go after Argentina and create and foment scandals there against this government. It's a very it's a new mixed strategy, but it all indicates the U.S. reorienting again towards Latin America in this policy. But all this is challenging, dealing with the challenges to neoliberalism, you see. And that's why Greece is important. It's another challenge to neoliberalism. Greece is also important because of is part of this centrifugal set of developments in Europe that promise over a long, medium term, longer term to break up Europe once again. Right? It undermines European unity. Because the rest of Europe is run by the bankers and capitalists there, and they like neoliberalism, and they don't like this challenge. That's why, from the very beginning, I believe it's clear now, the Northerners have set out to get rid of Syriza. You see, Syriza wants old-fashioned European democracy. That's dead, you know. And the struggle over labor market reforms, over pensions, over sales taxes, and all this between the Troika of the North and Greece, on the other hand, is really a reflection of can we allow Greece to be an old-fashioned social democratic European economy and country within the Eurozone? No, it doesn't work, right? You have to be part of the neoliberal arrangement or else you can't be in it, right? That's the conflict. It's neoliberal versus pre-neoliberal, which it's all oil and water. They don't really mix, right? But we see in Europe, you know, that there are centrifugal pressures rising, right, in Europe on a number of fronts here. After 6 years of stagnation and double-dip recessions and so forth, we're seeing the beginning of political realignments on parties beginning to occur. And a number of these parties, whether they're on the left or the right, are saying, we want out. We want out. Even in Britain, this movement for British exit from the European Union is significant. And, of course, we see Scotland versus the rest of the UK. And we can see the same thing going on in Spain with Podemos, right, and other parties, even on the right-wing parties in the case of a National Front in France and so forth. They went out. In other words, there are forces leading to a breaking up of Europe. And if the Troika allowed Greece to simply exit, that would give more impetus to these forces that are moving to break up Europe, right? There are other severe issues that are causing divisions in Europe at the same time. One is this immigration issue. We got massive, massive immigration flowing into Southern Europe in particular, and then crossing the borders because it's open labor migration in the Eurozone and European Union. So we have these massive, particularly from the Middle East and Africa, moving into Southern Europe, and they can't contain it, really. And that's going to cause problems, significant problems. Well, why do you have this massive immigration? Well, and a lot of it has to do with U.S. foreign policies that have the Europeans in tow. In other words, the U.S. has created a series of failed states in the Middle East and in Africa, whether it's Libya, right, or Syria, or now Yemen and the Horn of Africa, right? You destroy these states' abilities to govern, and people desperate, they leave. And where are they going to go? They're going to go where there's safety and there's jobs. Where's that? Oh, that's Europe. So, you know, the closest they can get, right? You know, they're flowing into Europe in huge amounts, and the countries in which they're entering are feeling the pressure most, and that's Greece and Italy and to some extent, you know, Spain, so forth. So immigration may have a divisive role there in Europe. And then, of course, this whole thing about Russia and the Ukraine. Eastern Europe, of course, wants all the military hardware they can get. They're, you know, those elites there who are anti-Russian are desperate to maintain themselves. You know, they're driving, Western Europe and U.S. is progressively trying to drive Russia out of Europe and to make it look east, which is what it's doing, cutting deals with, you know, Asia and so forth. So European unity is an issue, and Greece impacts that, right? Greece challenges the neoliberal consensus. Greece represents a further escalation of European disunity, if they allow it. And now, Greece is also important to the European economy in an indirect way. The whole European economic strategy has been to drive down the cost of its products as a way of stimulating exports, You see, Germany is a very export-oriented country. 50%, I believe, of all its GDP is exports. A lot of those exports were to the periphery, right, in Europe. But now Germany has had a big push exporting, particularly to China. You know, they're cutting all kind of trade deals with China and so forth. Reducing the cost of their exports is the way they see themselves growing. They have a strategy here of export-driven growth because the economies in Europe have stagnated now for 5 years at least, right? Now, how do you get export-driven growth? Well, you pump massive amounts of QE money into the economy, drives down your currency, makes it more competitive. Right, but you also do it in a second way, and that is you drive down wages. Drive down wages is called internal devaluation, and by driving down wages, you also drive down your costs. So it's a dual strategy of using currency strategy, monetary driving currency strategy, and also labor market strategy, where you drive down wage costs. And together, the idea is to make European exports more. More competitive, I guess we would call it, and therefore export-driven growth in general. And again, also, you know, this massive liquidity injection, QE, also theoretically has the assumption that you drive up stock prices, and that will drive up balance sheets and make a business more prone to investing. Of course, that's not happening because the balance sheets, the stock prices aren't rising that much. And even if it did, there's not strong evidence that shows that it leads to investment, right? And the other thing is similar in parallel. If you theoretically, the argument is if you pump money QE into the economy, that will drive up the price level. And rising price levels will stimulate investment, right? So repairing balance sheets by QE, repairing price level by QE is supposed to lead to investment, but it doesn't. It hasn't, at least. Not only not in Europe, it hasn't in Japan. You know, even a more massive QE has occurred in Japan in recent years. You got a little bit of stimulus in the stock market, and then it turned flat. It collapsed once again. You got really no growth, and you got deflation going on again after trillions already spent by Japan. So they're going to have to come up with trillions more. You know, watch it. They'll do another QE of even more money. What we got is dueling QEs between Europe and Japan right now, because they're both oriented towards exports growth. So they're both fighting over a shrinking global trade pie, Europe and Japan. That's QE is really failing in Europe and in Japan. It's not resulting in price increases. It's not resulting in more real investment in those countries. But it's the major strategy that the elites want to continue to follow. And what you've got in the case of Greece, runs risks for that whole QE strategy in Europe, because if you've got to keep bailing Greece out, instead of that money QE money going to do the things they think it'll do, somehow that money has to be used to help bail out. ECB is part of the Troika. Some of that will have to be used to help bail out Greece. So it's diverting QE from its intended objectives, primary objectives. That's what Greece is. So, Greece is strategic for undermining potentially that whole European QE strategy for growth that I just described, right? And also, you know, the whole Greek thing could lead to what's called contagion effects. And a recent report just released yesterday by the IMF indicates, something about these contagion effects. I'll talk about that shortly. But what are the contagion effects? Well, first of all, currency. It could drive the euro down And if it drives the euro down, it drives up other currencies in the European Union. A good example of what's happening right now with Sweden and Denmark, right? The currencies are being driven up as the euro goes down. Oh, no one wants to hold euros, investors, so they go and they buy these other currencies as a hedge, you know, the Swiss franc, the Swedish kroner, and so forth. But what does that do? That drives up the value of those other currencies, makes them less competitive in terms of global export sales. So what their central banks do and are doing, both in Switzerland and Sweden, is to set negative interest rates. In other words, to if you're going to put your money in Swedish currency and Swedish banks, you're going to have to pay the banks. The banks aren't going to pay you. You have to pay the banks negative interest rates, right? And everywhere across Europe, outside the eurozone, outside the euro, but in the European Union, this pressure on currencies is occurring, which only slows down these economies, you see, in Sweden and Finland and so forth, even more. To protect their currency, they institute negative rates, and the negative rates slow down their economy. Okay, so currency instability is one form of contagion effect. The other form of possible contagion effects are, you know, driving up European bonds, right? Dampening the stock markets in Europe, right? Driving up government bond yields in the periphery and even in the core. Spillover from government bonds, possibly the corporate bonds, is always a potential as well. What if Greece banking system collapses? We don't know what the effect is going to be on other banking systems and other banks throughout Europe because we don't know what the connections are, the investment connections are, but it could be significant, right? So contagion effects can occur through the banking system. Now, at the same time, we have a problem in China. You know, the China bubbles. China has been going from bubble to bubble, financial bubble to bubble. And now the latest bubble is a stock bubble. And that looks like it's beginning to bust. Since June 12th, the stock market there, which ran up over 100% in 1 year, is down 25%. And the government can't seem to get its hand around stopping that decline, regardless what it does in China. So we got a bubble over there, and we got this problem in Greece that may be contagious over here. What if these two link up? You know, what if investors globally come to the conclusion, hey, the global economy is finally destabilizing once again, and, we better take our money and run. You see, there's this very difficult to quantify variable in global financial stability in capitalism that has to do with investor confidence. You know, you can't put a finger on that and quantify that very well. But one thing is true. When investors have made bundles of money, they get very nervous and they look for an excuse to take their money and run. And they've made bundles, historic bundles in recent years. And it may be this combination of China on the one hand and Greece and Europe on the other may be enough to convince them to take their money and run. And if so, then it's a total new ballgame here. And we'll just have to see how that turns out. So far, investors they pull back a little bit when there's a mini crisis, and then they throw their money back in. Oh, that's over. Right. So Greece is just another element that may undermine that global confidence. If you look at the global economy, we have the Greece potential exit, one that's destabilizing. We have China bubbles. We don't know where that's going to go. We have the prospect of rising U.S. interest rates, and therefore a rise in the dollar is going to slow down the U.S. economy. It looks like in recent weeks, oil prices, global oil prices, are again going to begin to fall. And emerging markets are growing increasingly concerned about their currencies and about capital flight from those countries. So if you look at the global picture, there's some real soft points in the global economy. Oh, by the way, Japan is dead on arrival as far as this QE. for the fifth time in 6 years. And you look at the U.S. so-called recovery, right? Not so good. We just had a report yesterday on jobs. Okay, we have a couple hundred thousand jobs, but no wage increase. All right, it means the jobs are part-time, low-quality jobs, is what it means. There's no generating of wage gains. So it doesn't matter what kind of how many jobs you create if people don't spend, you know. The other interesting thing about yesterday's report was over 400,000 people left the labor market. Well, if the labor market and the economy is doing so well, you would expect hundreds of thousands to come back in. But they're not coming back in. They're leaving. Well, that's not a sign of a very strong labor market, regardless of this jobs number. You know, the unemployment statistic is worthless to indicate what's really happening in the labor markets. And, you know, even these job numbers, I think, now are very suspect. They certainly don't indicate strength in the labor market. Well, we had a 0.7% collapse of GDP, the fourth time this has happened in single quarters since 2009, revised to only a negative 0.2%, right? But it looks like the second quarter in the U.S. is going to be fairly weak as well, less than 2%, and all the indications are that the third quarter is going to be less. So the U.S. is just bumping along the bottom, stop-go, somewhere between 0 and 2% on average. Job quality is poor. We have flat wages. And by the way, they say wages grow 2%, hourly wages, you know, but you know, that's everybody. And it's not weekly earnings. Weekly earnings is more important than hourly wages. And if you look at the median, wages are declining, right? Manufacturing is stagnant in the U.S. now because of exports declining and dollar rising. Construction is going on, but only for high-end housing, right? We have big price drags on consumption. Rents are escalating. This whole Obama ACA, premiums are rising for health care. The drought now is pushing up food prices, the drought in the West, where most of the food is produced, right? Business spending is flat, and government spending is only occurring significantly in the area of defense spending. That doesn't create a lot of jobs, you see. So the picture in the U.S. is not robust either, not robust. And that needs to be added to this instability in Europe, focused on Greece, bubbles in China, prospect of U.S. rate increases, rising value of the dollar, oil prices beginning to fall again, emerging markets under increasing stress. Right? Okay, so where are we with, just to summarize, with the last week of the Greek debt deal? Well, it looks like, you know, the IMF published a report saying Greece is going to need $66 billion over the next 3 years, more. $36 billion has to come from other creditors. Now, it also said, though, that they're going to they suggest that the Greek debt be extended in terms of its maturity from 20-year bonds now debt to 40 years. That will lower the amount of payment that the Greeks will have to make, you see, and probably lower interest rates as well. Well, this is what Greece has been calling for. They've been calling for a restructuring of the debt. And the IMF is now signaling, despite all the acrimony in the public bargaining going on between the two sides, this is a signal by the IMF that, okay, Greece, we're giving you a way out. If you accept this, we will restructure your debt. But, of course, the Greeks are going to have to bite the bullet and agree to more concessions. So it's concessions for debt relief and debt extension. And, you know, right now this referendum vote looks pretty mixed. Looks like 43% to 42%, yes or no. Right. And there are other offensives that are trying to challenge this vote itself. And even if the vote goes through, there probably will be legal challenges declaring the vote illegal. So that's plan C by the Eurocrats with their friends within Greece. Even if the Greeks vote no. Right. Even if they vote no and to reject this, the last offer of the the Troika, there will be moves to negate that no. If they vote yes, well, then the Greeks aren't in very good bargaining situation here. What's going to happen, I believe, is a settlement. What's going to happen is a settlement at the last minute in which the Greeks will agree to more concessions, but they will get a debt extension, you see. And there may be a few sweeteners here and there, maybe for elderly pensions. People already are the poor on pensions. The Troika may concede a little bit here or there, but it will be mostly the Troika's a plan A proposal of recent weeks in exchange for debt extension and debt relief. I think that's where things are going. Okay, so we'll watch next week when the vote comes out. Streets are screaming now.